Florida Frontiers, the weekly radio magazine of the Florida Historical Society, is made possible in part by the Department of State, Division of Historical Resources, and the State of Florida. It's also made possible by the Jesse Ball DuPont Fund and by the historic Rossiter House Museum and Gardens in O'Galley, celebrating pioneer history, the natural environment, and women's history. Available for weddings and events at rossiterhousemuseum.org. This is Florida Frontiers, the weekly radio magazine of the Florida Historical Society, on the web at myfloridahistory.org. I'm Ben Brotmarkle, and coming up on the program, we'll visit the Du Bois Pioneer Home in Palm Beach County.
Harry Du Bois started coming down to Florida in the winters in the early 1890s as a teen.
We'll discuss efforts to move from desegregation to integration.
At the University of Florida, the school's athletic desegregation coincided with a debate over the marching band's use of the song Dixie.
And we'll talk about the podcast This Day in Miami. All that ahead on Florida Frontiers.
Our house is a very, very, very fine house with two cats in the yard.
Du Bois Park by Jupiter Inlet in Palm Beach County is steeped in Florida history. Some speculate that Ponce de Leon landed near here in 1513, and Jonathan Dickinson did shipwreck near here in 1696. The 1898 Du Bois Pioneer Home was built on top of what is now a 30-foot-tall grassy hill in the park, but as site manager Diana Hutchison explains, the hill was originally part of a large shell mound system constructed thousands of years ago by the Yaga people.
This immediate area, this park, we have evidence with artifacts dating back to up to about 6,000 years. So we have up to 6,000 years of human habitation on this site. It intensifies a great deal about 4,000 years ago. We do have some of the oldest types of pottery, indigenous pottery in Florida, called orangeware, found at this site. The mound, the best carbon dates we have right now for the mound are between about 600 CE to 1100 or 1200 CE. So that was a more recent construction, but it was at its largest was about 700 feet long and about 20 to 30 feet tall. It's currently only about a third of its size. It also had causeways. They were called kind of running off perpendicular. So it was really a large network of mounds, not just one mound.
Much of the Yaga shell mound network was destroyed in the early 1900s to provide material to build roads. In addition to oyster shells, the mounds contained remains of fish, shark, dolphin, the bones of the extinct Caribbean monk seal, as well as Yaga pottery. Harry Du Bois was intrigued by the shell mounds. Diana Hutchison.
Harry Du Bois started coming down to Florida in the winters in the early 1890s as a teen. His family was from New York. He had some health problems. The winters up north did not agree with him. He tried one winter to work in a foundry up there, and that was really terrible for his health. So he started coming down here. First, he was working with a cousin up in more the Sebastian area at a citrus grove. So he found a variety of jobs, small jobs to do.
Eventually, Harry Du Bois made his way to Jupiter Inlet, where he bought a pineapple farm and met his future wife in 1897. She was a new local school teacher from Kansas named Susan Sanders.
According to the family lore, the two of them were set up on a blind date to go to the lighthouse. And when they saw each other in the light of the lighthouse, they fell in love. By the time they finished their date, he'd convinced her to be his girlfriend. Within days, he had contacted the owner of this property and was working towards buying it. Apparently, Susan had expressed that she wanted to live on a hillside by the sea to see the ships go by. And so apparently that's something he was trying to accomplish for her. And so he built first just one story. It was very small at first. He wanted because he grew up in New York, his family would, in the summer, vacation on the New Jersey coast. And so he wanted a New Jersey style home. So that's why it looks the way it does, the Victorian shingle style home. So first he built just the first floor. And then in 1903, as the family rapidly grew, because they did end up having four children in pretty rapid succession in 1903, another downstairs bedroom as well as the entire upstairs was added on, and the house was greatly expanded.
Even today, visitors to Du Bois Park will notice bees flying around the property. Diana Hutchison.
Harry Du Bois was probably one of the first successful professional apiarists in South Florida. He was very enterprising. He did many different things to, earn the money and, get the food on the table for his family. But one of the most successful was the honey business, where he had, he would rent the hives all up and down the coast. He would have hundreds of hives rented out to different citrus groves. And one year, I believe at the height of their business, they made 90,000 gallons of honey in one year.
Harry Du Bois suffered from pernicious anemia and died at the age of 53 in 1924.
Within a year, Susan had decided to move in with her family, that was down in West Palm Beach. And the children had by that time houses elsewhere on the property that were kind of more modest, but they stayed on the property except for the daughter. But the family actually decided to rent out this home. So after Harry died, after the mid-1920s, no one in the Du Bois family really lived in that home. It was rented out to, people visiting, which, in its own way is a very Florida thing to have happened.
Diana Hutchison is manager of the 1898 Du Bois Pioneer Home in Du Bois Park by Jupiter Inlet in Palm Beach County. Docent-led tours of the home are available Tuesday through Thursday from 10 a.m. to 1 p.m. The home is only accessible via a tall staircase up a hill.
You place the flowers in the vase that you bought today.
This is Florida Frontiers, the weekly radio magazine of the Florida Historical Society. I'm Ben Brotmarkle. Visit us anytime online at myfloridahistory.org to find great books on Florida history and culture, watch our public television series Florida Frontiers, and much more. That's myfloridahistory.org.
Well, I wish I was in the land of coffin wood, and there I'm not forgotten.
Joining us now is Connie Lester, Associate Professor of History at the University of Central Florida, Director of the Riches Digital Archiving Project, and Editor of the Florida Historical Quarterly. Connie, the history of sports has emerged as a discipline that provides a very useful lens of social analysis. Over the past two decades, the Florida Historical Quarterly has published a number of articles on college athletics that provide insights not only to the programs themselves, but also into broader issues of race, education, and social change.
In the spring of 2010, Derek E. White, now professor of history at the University of Kentucky, published an article in the Quarterly that used the football program at the University of Florida in the period 1962 to the mid-1970s to understand the transformation of the school from one that desegregated to one that integrated. White draws upon a speech by Martin Luther King Jr. titled The Ethical Demands of Integration, delivered in Nashville in 1962, to understand the differences between desegregation and integration, terms that are often used interchangeably. King defined desegregation as the removal of the legal and social prohibitions of segregation. Integration, however, is the positive acceptance of desegregation that includes welcomed participation in the total range of human activities. Desegregation followed the passage of the Civil Rights Act. Integration proved to be a longer process. To analyze the forces of desegregation and the resistance to integration on the UF campus, White proposes all as the collegiate ideal of the combination of community and campus culture that was associated with traditional American small campuses in the mid-20th century. He argues that making football the lens for exploring desegregation and integration also demands attention to the marching band, which was essential to the athletic and collegiate spirit. Utilizing both the football team and the marching band provides a more complete analysis of the differences between a desegregated campus and an integrated one that incorporates both campus culture and geography. The athletic field, the stands, and the classrooms at UF, he argues, reveal that, quote, Black students were merely tolerated, not integrated, in the initial process of desegregating Southern universities. In order to integrate, UF had to alter the collegiate identity, integrate Black students into its community, and a campus culture that centered on football. At the University of Florida, the school's athletic desegregation coincided with a debate over the marching band's use of the song Dixie, end quote.
And Connie, by starting in 1962, White incorporates an important milestone in UF football history, the victory over the Penn State Nittany Lions in the Gator Bowl.
Not only was 1962 the year of the Gator Bowl victory, it was also the year when the first Black undergraduates were admitted to the campus. Graduate and professional students had been admitted to UF in 1958. The bowl game encapsulates the argument that desegregation did not integrate Black students into the campus culture of football. Florida was not initially viewed as a contender for a Gator Bowl invitation. Other teams, including Oregon State, with its Heisman Trophy winner Terry Baker, seemed a better choice for the ninth-ranked Penn State. The choice of UF was an economic one that promised a sellout crowd. The Florida-Penn State game quickly became a regional North versus South clash and racial desegregated versus segregated teams. As White observes, quote, the two teams played the 1962 game amid a growing civil rights movement and at a moment when Southern universities began to desegregate. In addition, the game occurred as the centennial commemoration of the Civil War got underway, end quote. As incidents at the University of Georgia and the University of Mississippi show, quote, students, alumni, and boosters often blurred the lines between school spirit, team spirit, and racist opposition to desegregation, end quote. Although the University of Florida prided itself on integration without incident, White argues, quote, when the Gator Bowl cast the team as a substitute for the embattled South, the team exceeded expectations in fulfilling the role, and UF embraced the game as one for Southern honor, end quote. Confederate battle flag patches were sewn onto team uniforms, and the flag also replaced the numbers on helmets. The marching band led the team onto the field to the strains of Dixie and waved a Confederate flag. In the aftermath of the UF 17-7 defeat of Penn State, the Pittsburgh Post-Gazette headline read, quote, Rebel flag, Dixie music, give Gators teeth, end quote. As White summarized the game, it was a contest between the South's racial past and its future, and on this day, it seemed the past won.
And Connie, the juxtaposition of UF's defense of Southern honor in a very public spectacle and the desegregation of the campus is striking. For Black students, the message was clear that they were not accepted into campus life. The continuing rise in the number of Black students admitted to desegregated campuses pressured colleges to make substantive changes to campus life.
Stephen Mickle, a member of the first cohort of Black undergraduates at UF, recalled being ignored by his classmates. Quote, it was like you were a piece of furniture. You did not exist, end quote. During homecoming, Confederate symbols were everywhere, and members of the Kappa Alpha fraternity dressed in Confederate uniforms. It was clear that Black students were tolerated, but not integrated into campus life. The barriers began to fall in the South when the University of Maryland recruited Daryl Hill, and Wake Forest University announced its intention to recruit Black players. In 1966, the University of Kentucky desegregated the SEC, and the University of Miami signed Ray Bellamy to an athletic scholarship. The University of Florida desegregated football in 1968. By that time, White observed, quote, desegregation had enough momentum that no college president could stop it, end quote. Desegregation occurred first with the U.S. track team by signing Ron Coleman to a scholarship. Even then, the football team first created token desegregation by insisting to a means testing to counter court-mandated desegregation. In case after case, potential players were found to not be qualified for admission, a delaying tactic with a long history. UF appeared to want a player who represented the Jackie Robinson model, which White describes as middle class in background and who had prior experience on desegregated teams in desegregated schools. The first two successful recruits met the unvoiced criteria. Both Leonard George and Willie Jackson attended desegregated high schools in Tampa and Sarasota. The reaction to this decision was mixed. For the most part, there was little opposition, but a vocal minority voiced their views on the supposed benefits to both races of maintaining segregation. In 1967, the University of Florida enrolled 61 black students out of a total student population of 19,000. Creating a more inclusive campus was essential in protecting black students and implementing integration. Integrating the football team was an important step. Ending the playing of Dixie by the marching band was the next step, one fraught with potential pushback. As in the recruitment of athletes, the University of Miami led the way when the school's president informed the band that it could no longer play Dixie. White characterized President Stanford's decision as paternalistic rather than based on principle. Stanford defended his decision by appealing to his Southern heritage, stating that it is not honorable to force upon a minority group the symbols of the Confederacy. Student opposition to this decision focused on Dixie as a reflection of Southern pride rather than bigotry, or questioned Stanford's right to a unilateral decision on the matter. Student protest ended after a few weeks. When UF President Stephen O'Connell did not follow Stanford's lead, student editorials in the Alligator, the student newspaper, suggested that the song should be eliminated. Some faculty members joined the students in calling for the ban. But a survey of the student body told a different story. 83% favored continuation of the playing of Dixie. As one black student said, quote, I don't feel anything about Dixie being played at the games. I could care less because I am not really part of the university. I don't do anything but go to classes, end quote. UF administration was unwilling to make the decision that the University of Miami president made. In 1971, black students took matters into their own hands, staging a protest in President O'Connell's office, demanding an increase in the number of black students, faculty members, and staff. They were arrested, but changes began to be made. White places the move to integrate the UF campus in 1973. That year, Frank B. Wicks, the new band director, removed Dixie from the band's playlist, saying that the tune was too controversial. In the fall, Coach Doug Dickey named Don Gaffney as the first starting black quarterback in the SEC. In his first two starts, he broke a 14-game losing streak at Auburn's Jordan-Hare Stadium and led an 11-10 come-from-behind victory over arch-rival University of Georgia. During the annual homecoming celebration, the students voted Cynthia Mays as the first black homecoming queen. As White concludes, quote, the examination of UF's shift from desegregation to integration suggests careful use of language when examining university desegregation. By locating the transition from desegregation to integration in colleges, scholars can provide a more nuanced understanding of the process. We as scholars must comprehensively assess desegregation and integration by examining the classrooms, the athletic fields, and the student culture. University integration requires that all three be desegregated.
And Connie, it's interesting to note that today the Super Bowl opened with Lift Every Voice and Sing, the Black National Anthem, written in Jacksonville, Florida in 1905. Thanks.
You're welcome.
Connie Lester is Associate Professor of History at the University of Central Florida, Director of the Riches Digital Archiving Project, and Editor of the Florida Historical Quarterly. This is Florida Frontiers. As Sebastian Garcia reports, This Day in Miami is a popular podcast.
Matthew Bunch is the creator and host of the award-winning This Day in Miami History podcast. This podcast was awarded the 2023 Hampton Dunn Digital Media Award from the Florida Historical Society. The Hampton Dunn Digital Media Award recognizes outstanding digital media projects expanding knowledge of Florida history. Although Matthew's originally from Baltimore, Maryland, he has lived in Miami since 2005. He received his bachelor's in journalism and economics at the University of Miami and his master's in American history at Gettysburg College. In addition to podcasting, Matthew's a full-time high school social studies teacher at Mast Academy and a part-time online producer for the Miami Herald. I spoke with Matthew about the origins, development, and significance of his This Day in Miami History podcast. Matthew shared with me that the idea of the show had bounced in his head for about a decade, and one lingering question finally catalyzed him to create it.
In Miami, we have the Metro Rail, which is our main rail transportation. And when I moved to Miami in 2005, and until I think 2012, it didn't run to the airport, and it drove me insane. Like, why have this if it doesn't go to the airport, if nowhere else it needs to go to the airport? And so for years, even after it opened, I'm like, why didn't it go to the airport? And then 2021 was coming off of a year of really not being able to go out and do a lot of things because of the coronavirus pandemic. And so I just was kind of stuck at home. And I'm like, you know what? I'm going to try to answer that question I've had in my head for the last decade. And I just started digging into, which I've always loved to do, newspaper archives. And I found out a lot of interesting things about the Metro Rail, but I couldn't find the answer to that. And so I'm like, you know what? I'm going to answer this. And I've already done so much work. I eventually contacted the former transportation committee chairperson for the Miami-Dade County Commission, a man named Charles Dussault. And I just messaged him on Facebook and LinkedIn. I was like, can I talk to you? I'm thinking about doing a podcast. And he was super accommodating. And he answered the question for me. And at the end of it, I'm like, yeah, this is a show. This is something. Let's do it.
With a tremendous variety of digital media sources available, Matthew chose podcasting because it enables him to reach audiences who otherwise would not have access to these crucial stories within Miami's history.
I chose podcasting because I wanted something that was accessible. And there is absolutely a place for writing. I love to read books, but you can tell different stories in different ways. And if you get too bogged down in like, well, history has to be written and you have to do this Chicago style footnote here, and then this, that, and the other, and your end notes and whatever. But at some point you lose a lot of people, and the people you lose are oftentimes the people who know the least and need to know the most. And so my goal is to produce something that if you can give me 15-ish minutes, you're going to leave knowing a lot more about a specific thing that should be important to our community than you probably knew before. And hopefully it will answer a question you had, and maybe it's answering a question you didn't know you need to have. So that's why I thought this is the perfect way to, again, literally get into people's brains, get into their ears, have them think about something, have them learn something new, have them hear something they would have never heard before, and think a little bit about the place where we live.
Engaging with the place that we live speaks to the emphasis and attention Matthew gives to local history, which is often incredibly overlooked.
Only in the last couple of decades have we really seen an awareness that you can tell a much larger story with a local story. And I love our local history. I think it's documentarian Billy Corbin that says, you know, the Miami of today is the America tomorrow. And it's why I like to focus so much on Miami history. And I do my best to pull out these stories and try to make connections between what happened here then, what happened here now.
Matthew does not just talk the talk regarding local history. He's equally concerned with and actively involved in preserving Miami's rich past. Through his podcast, he has partnered with local organizations to widen public awareness regarding the importance of protecting Miami's historic sites and community memory. These efforts are timely, given the city's remarkably rapid growth in recent years.
We have so many great organizations down here, and I've been able to talk to, you know, like the Miami Design Preservation League, Daniel Seraldo there, talk to them basically when like something's on fire. It's like, hey, Tallahassee's going to pass this law and basically, you know, Ocean Drive could get plowed over. Let's talk to try to do something about it. But to actually be a little bit more proactive and just work with local organizations outside of like crisis time, that would be really great too. Because ultimately, we're all trying to push the same rock up the hill. And that is to kind of preserve our history and ensure both that we can tell those stories and preserve it. And understanding that Miami is a city still in the process of growing and how we can facilitate that necessary growth while at the same time respecting and preserving the history, so much history that's already around us.
Matthew's ability to effectively construct his narrative episodes with primary source evidence at once legitimizes his podcast as a serious work of scholarship and how history can be told in different ways.
when it comes to my process of getting and finding primary sources, I always start with two things. I always start with my newspapers.com subscription. And one of the great resources in all of America for primary video and audio, and that's the Wolfson Archive at Miami-Dade College, which is, we are so blessed to have a place that just basically has every news broadcast for the last 50 years. I don't think Miamians know how much of an amazing resource that is for both our history and national and world history. So I always start there, and they pretty much get a shout out every single episode, and then just kind of build out from there. And sometimes finding the audio and the video through the Wolfson and going to the newspapers and kind of digging around there might be enough. And then sometimes you want to go deeper.
Aside from the fascinating, quirky, and unique stories that define Miami's past, there is a more profound significance as to why Matthew examines Miami as a subject of historical investigation.
I think there are a lot of lessons in Miami's history that are very applicable. And this is a community in which a lot of people were not born here, were not raised here, may not know anything about our community's history. And in fact, that may be a majority. And so as people who I am a transplant too, admittedly, but I've now lived here longer than I lived in Baltimore. I view Miami as my home. And as a transplant, I could have just said, I don't care. Moving on, get rid of it. Miami's, you know, it's my plaything. I want to make it into what I want to make of it. But that erases all the things that made Miami the place I wanted to move to in the first place. And I feel like the most important thing in communicating our community's history is to lay the breadcrumbs in line to get people from, hey, I'm new here, I don't care, to, wow, this is a really cool place. And we do, as a newbie, I have to involve myself in understanding what are the things that are really important that make Miami, Miami, and how can I take an active role in making sure that it remains that way. And hopefully that's something that I can help accomplish with the show, is bringing more people into the fold to protect our physical and institutional memory in a way that the character of Miami remains.
Listen to the This Day in Miami History podcast on Apple, Spotify, and anywhere else you can listen to podcasts. New episodes are released every month. Also, follow Matthew on social media with the handle @ThisDayInMiamiPod. To learn more about Matthew Bunch and the development of his podcast, please check out my entire conversation with Matthew on Knight's History Cast, which is available on all podcast platforms as well. For Florida Frontiers, I'm Sebastian Garcia, a graduate history student, FHS Media Production Assistant, and history podcaster at the University of Central Florida Department of History.
You've been listening to Florida Frontiers, the weekly radio magazine of the Florida Historical Society. Please join us right here again next week. Until then, you can find us on Facebook and visit us anytime online at myfloridahistory.org. Production assistance for Florida Frontiers comes from Connie Lester and Sebastian Garcia. The program is edited by Giselle Concepcion. Have a great week. I'm Ben Brookmarkle. Florida Frontiers, the weekly radio magazine of the Florida Historical Society, is made possible in part by the Department of State Division of Historical Resources and the State of Florida. It's also made possible by the Jesse Ball DuPont Fund and by the historic Rossiter House Museum and Gardens in O'Galley, celebrating pioneer history, the natural environment, and women's history. Available for weddings and events at rossiterhousemuseum.org.